The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. I hope everyone's doing well today. We're going to start with Oprah's Insiders. Oprah on being more mindful online. All of us are vulnerable to those algorithms which can deal so much damage to our mental health, our social life, and our time management. Hey, Insiders. Back on video, we're reading Wellness by Nathan Hill from my book club this month. It's about, among other things, the travails of a modern marriage. But the part of the book that I found really fascinating was when the author, Nathan Hill, gets into the science of algorithms. All the ways that social media is trained to filter our complexity and promote the most reactive, the most divisive, and the most upsetting content. I don't want to give too much away, especially if you're reading on our reading schedule, but one of the characters in this book illuminates how algorithms can alter your thinking and your relationships. And I imagine that some of you know somebody in your own life who's just gone down that rabbit hole. Maybe they came back. Maybe they didn't. Of course, social media has so many advantages for connection, but all of us are vulnerable to those algorithms which can deal so much damage to our mental health, our social life, and our time management. Here on Oprah Daily, we have a new article that teaches us how to begin to outsmart these algorithms so that you have control over your own social media and not the other way around. So for this week's intention, I want you to be more mindful of how you're spending your time online. How do the accounts that you're following and the posts that you're seeing make you feel? How much time are you spending online? How can you curate your social media to bring you greater inspiration, more connection and joy? I know all of you who are communicating in this community feel some of that connection, and I'd love to hear what strategies have worked for you in the comments below in fighting the algorithms. Go well and have a beautiful week. We're moving on into relationships. This article is How to Say I Love You Like You Really, Really Mean It. A couples therapist, a romance novelist, and a songwriter share their trade secrets. Those three little words can be huge. Like when you say them to someone for the first time, conveying the sense of wonder, joy, and awe you feel as you fall head over heels. They're also a shorthand, but no less heartfelt way to tell people how much you care. And an abbreviated version serves as a casual sign-off to a chat with a partner, relative, or friend. Lately, I've even heard work colleagues say it to each other, "Bye, love you." It seems we're all loving each other more than ever. Or at least saying we do. And then there's the related, I appreciate you, which has bubbled up as another all-purpose conversation closer. The Verizon customer service agent said it to me just the other day. Does throwing these important words around make them less important? Should we save them for when they really matter? I put this question to renowned linguist Deborah Tannen, author of You Just Don't Understand, and 12 other books, and professor of linguistics at Georgetown University. That's how language works, she said. Any phrase that gets wide currency, it's going to be used in different ways, and people will suspect it's being overused. But she's not worried about love being devalued, even if your pal in the next cubicle professes hers for you and she heads out the door as she heads out the door. I actually like it, says Tannen, adding that we need handy phrases to open and close conversations. The fact that something with such a positive meaning is adapted that way, I think that's a good thing. To give your words more weight, you might modify them. I really love you, or I love you so much. But if you want to express your feelings in a way that feels less routine and a lot more personal and meaningful, here are tips from three pros. The couples therapist. Creating a culture of appreciation in a relationship is crucial, says Satira Streeter Corbett, a licensed clinical psychologist, certified Gottman therapist, and founder of Ascension's Psychological Services in Washington, D.C. And you can't do that by just saying, I love you. You need to let the person know exactly what they are doing that makes you feel connected to them. She even has a formula for it. A formula may not sound romantic, but this is an incredibly effective way to communicate and bring you closer. Pretty romantic, right? Here's how it works. Start by thinking of an adjective that describes a quality you admire in your partner or another person you're close to. Then consider how it makes you feel. Finish up with an example of that behavior. Corbett brings it to life this way. If you're talking to your husband, you might say, "You are so thoughtful, and your kind gestures make me feel really supported by you. Like yesterday, when you made my lunch to take to work because you knew I would be too busy in the morning to do it myself. I really appreciated that." Or for a friend, "You are so kind and insightful. It makes me feel I can come to you and trust you with anything. Like last weekend when I wasn't sure how to handle that situation at work, you gave me such solid advice that really helped me." Adjective plus feeling plus example. This formula does both of you good, creating a positive cycle. There are so many times that the people we love do things and our heart grows for them, says Corbett, but we don't really take time to figure out why. Take that time, figure it out, and share it. The more you tell people about the specific characteristics and actions you appreciate, the more they'll exhibit them, and the more you're going to love them. The Romance Novelist. Claire Kahn, and that's K-A-N-N, author of The Romantic Agenda and Looking for Love in All the Haunted Places, out next May, is specific when it comes to language in her books and in her life. If you're going to tell someone, "I appreciate you," say why you appreciate them, she says. "I appreciate you for bringing me lunch. That made my whole day." Acknowledge what they've done for you. That way, the person knows that this isn't just the casual thing you say all the time. Knowing your audience, as it were, is also important. What makes one person feel warm inside might not do it for another. We're all different, and we need different things, says Kahn. Just paying attention to the person is the first step to creating or to crafting the kinds of compliments and affection that they would like to receive. Kahn creates this dynamic when developing characters. In her forthcoming novel, the protagonist, Lucky, feels like no one sees her. So when her love interest says these three little words, not the usual ones, but "I see you," it's powerful. IRL, that might translate to reassuring someone who is anxious, praising the work of someone insecure about their abilities, or telling someone who struggles with maintaining relationships what a wonderful friend they are. The Songwriter. Love is a human experience, says Rodney Alejandro, a musician, songwriter, and the chair of the songwriting department at Boston's Berklee College of Music. He has also performed with Will.i.am, Stevie Wonder, Eric Clapton, Paulina Rubio, and CeeLo Green. That emotion, most people are going to have some relationships with it. So to stand out, find aspects of that of love that can be expressed in a way that's unique. One simple way to get at that, point out the subtle things you notice when you love someone, the idiosyncrasies or habits that seem unimportant, but when they're not there, you miss them like crazy, he says. The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea. Another technique to steal. Songwriters often try to find a distinctive, meaningful aspect of a relationship and build an entire song around it. One example Alejandro cites in Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time, it expresses loving somebody by saying, "I'm going to be here no matter what happens." He says, "Don't remember the lyrics? If you're lost, you can look and you will find me, time after time. If you fall, I will catch you, time after time." Another example, a song by indie artist Bruno Major calling Nothing. It's brilliant because it just talks about the mundane routine of life, of living with somebody, Alejandro says. Tracksuits and red wine, movies for two. We'll take off our phones and we'll turn off our shoes. There's nothing like doing nothing with you. Are you feeling it? How can you not be? You don't have to be a musician to work this magic. You just have to think about what makes your relationship special and communicate it the best way you can with just one rule. Say, I love you without actually saying it. Hey, in wellness, the next article is what to say when someone you love is hurting. When words fail you, just be present and remember the three S's: sensitivity, support, and space. Bereavement, illness, divorce, job loss. Anyone who has lived to middle age has taken more than a few hits. And yet, when someone close to us is suffering mightily and we want to express love and support, we often find ourselves tongue-tied or defaulting to a generic, I'm so sorry. Grief specialist David Kessler, author of Finding Meaning, the Sixth Stage of Grief, is a counselor who has worked with the LAPD and the Red Cross in trauma situations. On his website, grief.com, the most visited page is the best and worst things to say to people in grief, and it is most visited in the middle of the night, he says. This tells me that people are up and trying to figure out the right words. That uncertainty comes from a place of fear, but also compassion. We want to say something meaningful, but we don't want to add to a person's pain. How to thread that needle? Here's what a few experts suggest. First and foremost, don't avoid the issue. The worst thing we can say when someone is hurting may be nothing at all. Tan meat sethi, and that's T-A-N-M-E-E-T, second name is S-E-T-H-I, M-D, a Sikh, S-I-K-H, American integrative and psychedelic medicine physician, activist, and author of the book Joy Is My Justice, felt this firsthand when her then 3-year-old son was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a debilitating terminal illness. She was confused and hurt when her loving parents regularly asked her husband how she was doing rather than asking her directly. When she questioned them, they explained, if you're feeling bad, we don't want to make it worse, and if you're feeling good, we don't want to bring you down. While Sethi understands the impulse, she pointed out to them that her grief is always there, even if it's alongside happiness. There are nights I don't want to talk about it. I just want to have a drink, she says. But I never, never don't appreciate it when someone asks how I'm doing. I have never felt like, oh God, why'd you bring that up? I'd forgotten about it. In other words, saying something is always better than saying nothing. The truth is, there are no magic words to fix a divorce or a loss, says Kessler. People really want to know that they're seen. It's completely okay to say, oh my gosh, I don't know the right words to say, but I'm here and I love you. Also think about how you normally communicate with the person and take it up a notch, says Kessler. If you usually message on social media, but you have their number, text. If it's usually a text, call. This is probably one of the biggest things they're going through in their life. It's a moment for us to show up a little bigger, too. Don't bright side the situation either. That's what Kessler calls it when we insist on shoving a silver lining in a hurting person's face. There is a time to cheer people up, but it's when they're ready, not when they're in pain, she says. Another pointer, don't begin sentences with at least, which is minimizing and dismissive. At least you don't have to put up with your husband snoring anymore if they're divorcing. Or at least now you can go get a job you like. Etiquette expert Lisa Grotz advises against statements that try to turn a loss into a blessing, such as, it was their time to go. Or, they're in a better place. Or, God doesn't give us more than we can handle. These pat answers lack support, compassion, and empathy. Your job is to offer comfort, says Grotz, not to magic away someone's sadness. Ask about their experience and offer tangible support. When people say, I can't imagine what you're going through, says Kessler, I always answer, you don't have to. I'm going through it, so just ask me questions. The key is to ask broad questions that don't assume that their grief will mirror yours or anyone else's. An open-ended, how are you feeling, is always a safe bet. As you listen to the answer, use your imagination to answer the question, "What can I do for you?" This takes the onus off the bereaved person having to stage manage your support. If she goes, "Oh my gosh, I'm struggling to keep up with the kids," hear that and say, "You know what? I could take the kids to soccer for you. I could drop over a dinner so it's ready for you when you get home," says Kessler. Another helpful gesture, let your loved ones know that your offer has no expiration date. In moments or challenges, no one knows what they need, points out Seti. Swoop in and say, "I'm available to get groceries on these days. Would any of that be helpful? If you don't know now, here's my number, and remember that you can text or call me." When you go blank, just be honest. If you are unsure of what to say, says Seti, own the moment authentically instead of trying to make some trite or wrapped-up statement. Start with, "I'm listening and I love you," or, "I don't know what to say, but I want to be here in any way I can." Kessler's go-to is similar. "I don't know the right thing to say, but I'm here and I love you." After that, let the conversation chart its own course. As it does, Grotz suggests keeping in mind the three S's, sensitivity, support, and space. Through your actions and words, you're essentially saying, "I hear you," she says. Continue to check in for weeks, months, even years. Grief isn't linear. It's cyclical, and it never really goes away. So when a loved one suffers a traumatic event, continue to check in, listen, and support, suggests Kessler. I always use the rule of three. I call it 3 days. I call it 3 weeks. I call it 3 months. Over time, that person's needs will change. When you check in, ask how they're feeling and validate their feelings because everyone is different, says Grotz, who lost her niece 2 years ago. 6 months ago, her sister informed her that she didn't want to discuss the loss anymore with anyone. We're having to change with it, says Grotz. It's hard, but we're giving her space and pace. It's also thoughtful to check in on milestones of a major loss. You might not want to upset someone by reminding them of, say, the anniversary of their mother's death. But guess what? No one forgets a death, Kessler says. It's so helpful to say, "I know how painful your mother's death has been. The anniversary is coming up, and I just want you to know I'm here." Occasionally, Kessler says, someone will come to him and say that they checked in with a grieving friend, and to their horror, "I made them cry." To that, Kessler responds, "You didn't make them cry. You made yourself a safe person to cry with." In books, join author Nathan Hill on a wellness tour of Chicago. The author takes you to the real bars, indie bookshops, and landmarks frequented by the characters in Oprah's 102nd book club pick. It's hard to read wellness and not long to join Jack, Elizabeth, and their merry band of artistic misfits as they tromp around the streets of Chicago's Wicker Park neighborhood, seeing the soon-to-be rock stars of the 90s before they were famous at tiny independent venues, crowding a booth at the coffee shop with the delightfully rude waitresses, or at 2 a.m. and falling in love between art openings and warehouse parties. This was a world that author Nathan Hill knew well during his college years in Iowa City. "I would sometimes travel with friends to Chicago," he says, "and we'd visit the bars and bookstores of Wicker Park and pretend to belong there." While writing Wellness in 2021, he returned to the Windy City for a research trip, visiting his old haunts with a vintage Polaroid 600 Land camera. "I enjoyed how the Polaroid made everything look nostalgic and antique, which seemed appropriate since I was writing about the 90s, says Hill. Through Nathan Hill's own collection of Polaroids, along with some other photos the author snapped over the years, we can step inside the world of wellness, traveling to many of the locals featured in the novel. Read on for a Chicago tour, so immersive you can practically smell the old books and spilled beer. The Myopic Bookstore. And it's a photo of an old bookstore. It says books, and it has sort of curved architecture on the outside of the building for each of the windows that are on the building. Hill took this photo of Myopic in Wicker Park, Jack's favorite place to get used books. The shop opened its doors in the early 90s. While so much of the neighborhood has changed, this beloved bookstore has remained. Boasting over 60,000 books and hosting live music and readings to the seemingly still aggressively cool locals. The Myopic is located just across the street from another Wicker Park literary establishment, Quimby's, an independent bookstore specializing in zines, comics, self-published books, and one-of-a-kind DIY miscellanea from local artists. In wellness, the young Jack and Elizabeth spend lazy afternoons hanging around Quimby's reading the local zines or the X-rated comics or the newest edition of Adbusters magazine. Over the years, the neighborhood has grown ritzier, but Quimby's has managed to maintain its brick-and-mortar Wicker Park location and its offbeat vibe, gleefully displaying printouts of underwhelmed Google reviews. Small choice of bookstore for teenagers who pretend to read books. And hawking their assorted fancies as state park pop-ups. This type of store, in a way, shouldn't be in this neighborhood now, with designer boutiques around the corner and stuff like that, says Quimby's owner, Eric Kersimer. But thankfully, it seems like it's here to stay. If you don't have a trip to the Windy City on the books, but find yourself in the Northeast, Quimby's now has a New York location, which opened in Brooklyn in 2017. Chicago's Blue Line. The Diamond Blue Line station, pictured above, lies right in the heart of Wicker Park in the 90s. This was the mecca of Chicago counterculture, as Jack's close friend and pseudo-landlord Benjamin insists in wellness, it's real. It's a place of substance. That's where the real art is happening and the real music, too. Not the fake corporate crap on the radio. Nathan Hill remembers that he was once drawn to the neighborhood for similar reasons. It had a screw-the-man kind of attitude, a don't-be-a-sheep type of vibe that was extremely attractive to the disaffected Gen X 20-year-old that I was at the time. I wanted to be a screw-the-man person, too. But Hill admits that even then he was aware of the distance between the sort of person he wanted to be and the sort of person he was. You pretended to be someone you're not to fit into a place that doesn't exactly want you. Jack and Elizabeth face a similar realization in wellness. They return to their old Wicker Park stomping grounds decades later, walking south on Diamond underneath the tracks of the Blue Line, past a wall of graffiti to a fancy hidden cocktail bar where Jack is schooled on his own role in gentrifying the neighborhood as a supposedly radical youth. The picture is black and white, and it just has the sign that says Diamond CTA Blue Line. The South Loop. The South Loop is the home to Chicago's famous Art Institute, Benjamin's fictional office building in wellness, and the very real skyscrapers above. Like Jack, Nathan Hill was interested in photography and, like Jack, found the 90s photography equipment prohibitively expensive. Unlike Jack, Hill did not invent a signature artistic style by recycling the film materials tossed by his fellow students. He simply bided his time and bought a digital camera, with which he eventually took the dramatic shot above. And the shot is kind of a purple sky, and it's a skyscraper, and it's showing a lightning bolt coming from the top of the skyscraper into the sky. I used to love watching summer lightning storms in Chicago, he explains. The rod atop the Sears Tower, I still can't quite get used to calling it the Willis Tower, would be especially lively. One summer evening during such a storm, I put my camera on a tripod and pointed it at the building and just kept shooting until I caught this. The Bean. So the picture is a big silver sculpture bean that's in the town that looks mirrored and has mirrored images of the clouds, and it has about 8 birds on top of it. Nathan Hill took this photo of Chicago's iconic Bean landmark years ago and remembered it as he was writing the scene, quoted above, when Elizabeth and Dr. Otto Sanborn meet at the sculpture to discuss the nature of true love. The pressures of matrimony and the possibility that we all might be living in a computer simulation. You know, just the small stuff. While the sculpture, designed by Indian-born British artist Anish Kapoor, is known around the world as The Bean, is known officially as the Cloud Gate. It's not hard to guess how the 110-ton landmark got its nickname. As Hill writes in Wellness, its shape was, one could not deny it, leguminous. Dr. Sanborn, a psychologist fascinated with human self-perception, delights in watching people watching their own strange images upon it, how their heads look distended or squished, and then moving a little this way or that way, now their bodies were distended or squished. The empty bottle. The picture is of a building front, and it's curved, the building front, so it looks like it might be on a corner, and it simply says the empty bottle. The empty bottle is the real Chicago bar where the fictional Jack and Elizabeth first meet. After weeks of pining at each other through their respective apartment windows, Elizabeth visits the venue, one of several local venues known for serious music that she's recently been persuaded to visit, invited by guys eager to impress her on a date with an insufferable proto-hipster eager to quiz her knowledge of grunge music and show off his own. Elizabeth only agrees to go in the hopes that she might run into Jack, who she's known to expect to see late at night at the Empty Bottle, or Rainbow Club, or Lounge Axe, or Phyllis's Musical Inn, all real mainstays of the 90s Chicago music scene. With his camera at work, and she'll watch him until her scrutiny and interest become unbearable, why don't you notice me? At this particular show, her dreams are finally realized. Elizabeth spots Jack through the thick, gridded window photographed above, his figure made wavy and rippled, distorted by the thick glass, and he points his camera right at her. It isn't long before he takes her hand and saying, "Come with." The Empty Bottle was founded in 1992, the same year Jack arrived in the city, and started out as a self-described cat-ridden hole-in-the-wall bar in Ukrainian Village, just south of Wicker Park, where you could get any one of 9 beers for $1.50 or less, play pool for 50 cents, and find everything from Monster Magnet to Bill Monroe on the jukebox. Today, the bar is still turning out tunes and brews, albeit at a slightly inflated price point. And we're over in culture and news now. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre on the importance of National Coming Out Day. The annual holiday is all about being authentically yourself. Today marks the 35th anniversary of National Coming Out Day. Back in 1988, the United States was the middle of the AIDS crisis. Same-sex marriage hadn't been legalized, and you could legally be fired for being gay. Let that sink in. Coming out was an act of bravery, an assertion that everyone deserves to be their true, authentic self. And while we have certainly made legal and cultural gains, the LGBTQIA+ community still faces significant discrimination. All to say, National Coming Out Day is just as important as ever. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, who has been open about the difficulties she faced coming out as a teen, took time to chat with us about the significance of the day and the strides we've made in LGBTQIA+ rights. Why is National Coming Out Day important? It's important to so many young people who are either still trying to figure it out or who are still looking for support in coming out. You don't even have to be young. It can be at any age. You're trying to figure out how you're going to live your truth. Be yourself and live your happiness. What do you see the role of Biden-Harris administration being when it comes to supporting the LGBTQIA+ community? One of the things I've always appreciated about being in this administration is that the Biden-Harris administration stands with the LGBTQ+ community. We have the back of that community, and we are fighting for them. We're going to continue to speak out and stand up for the rights and freedoms of this community. No one should be attacked for who they are or who they love. Homophobia lives in an atmosphere of silence and ignorance, which is what makes this day so much more important. It is a day when you can tell your story so that it will help lift someone up in your community that may need it. What strides has the administration made on behalf of the LGBTQIA+ community? There's a long list of actions that this administration has taken to protect and support the LGBTQ+ community. On the first day in his administration, the president was directing all essential federal agencies to strengthen civil rights, protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. It has led to strengthening protection in housing, health care, education, employment, and criminal justice. And in December of last year, he was able to sign the landmark Respect for Marriage Act, which protects the rights of same-sex and interracial couples fighting for the passage of Equality Act. There's still a lot of work to be done there, but he's fighting for it. Is there a resource you like to point to that can help LGBTQIA+ youth? One of the things I don't think is highlighted enough is the nationwide crisis hotline, which can be reached by dialing 988. It's so important that young people feel like they have a person that they call who will be able to talk to them about their particular issue. How powerful is that? I wish I had that when I was younger. This administration has been able to deliver on it, which is incredibly impactful. How has your own journey coming out shaped you? I came out to my mom when I was 16. It was a different time. Right after I came out, I went right back in the proverbial closet because she didn't take it well. It was very difficult for me. I wished that I had people who I could look up to who looked like me, who were out, who I could actually identify myself with. It goes into how much representation matters. I had it really hard growing up, trying to figure out myself and my identity. I really had to believe in myself because I only had myself to figure out how I was going to move through life. I'm much older now. I have a daughter. I have this career where I'm at the podium because of the president and Dr. Biden, two people who believed in me to represent this administration, this country. I want young people to know that it doesn't get better, that it does get better, and there are people who are here for you. This administration is going to have your back and want you to live your best life. This next article is in Relationships. Jada Pinkett Smith just revealed that she and Will have been separated since 2016. Here's the complete timeline of their relationship. Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith make up one of Hollywood's longest reigning couples and also one of its most candid. As an iconic power duo, the Smiths celebrated multiple awards wins, raised their kids, Jaden and Willow, as well as Smith's oldest son, Trey, from his first marriage to Cherie Zampino, and jumped out of a plane together. But after walking down the aisle in 1997, they've also been the subject of divorce rumors, infidelity gossip, and more. Now Pinkett Smith has revealed that the pair has been separated since 2016. While promoting her upcoming memoir, Worthy, on the Today Show, she shared that after the entanglement that first shook their marriage several years ago, more on that below, the duo never actually repaired their romantic relationship. Now Pinkett Smith isn't shying away from discussing her relationship with Smith and what the separation really means. Let's see how the Smiths' romance unfolded, then unraveled, plus their most defining moments as husband and wife. 1994, Jada met Will on the set of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Though the relationship between Smith, 55, and Pinkett Smith, 52, sounds like a story ripped straight from the plot of a romantic comedy, their meet-cute didn't have a traditional happy ending. They briefly met in 1994 when Pinkett Smith auditioned for a role as Smith's character's girlfriend on the 90s sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Unfortunately, the 5-foot actress didn't get the part because she was too short. Instead, the role went to Nia Long. Still, despite their drastic height difference, Pinkett Smith would soon become Smith's leading lady off-screen a few years later. To date, the pair have never appeared in a movie or on a TV show together. However, they have produced films through their joint production company, Overbrook Entertainment. 1995, the Smiths started dating. During a 2018 appearance on Red Table Talk, Pinkett Smith's web series, Smith expressed that he was attracted to Pinkett Smith when he later saw her on the college-themed TV series A Different World. "I knew there was something in our energy that would be magic," he said. Unfortunately, Smith was married at the time to Zampino, his first wife, and decided not to act on his attraction to Pinkett Smith. Smith later revealed on Red Table Talk that he knew Pinkett Smith was the one after an aha moment he had in a restaurant bathroom while he was on a dinner date with Zampino. "I had a realization I wasn't with the person I was supposed to be with," Smith said. I was sitting in a stall, and I was crying and laughing uncontrollably, and I knew Jada was the woman I was supposed to be with, but I was never getting divorced. I went back out, sat down with Cherie, and started going back on with my life. It wasn't until Zampino ended things with Smith that he tried to woo the actress. He asked Pinkett Smith if she was seeing anyone, and her response was no. "Cool, you're seeing me now," Smith smoothly told her. From there, Pinkett Smith moved from Baltimore to California, and the two began dating. Smith and Zampino officially divorced in late 1995. December 1997, Jada and Will got married. Smith officially asked for his wife's hand in marriage in November 1997. "One day we got engaged, and the next day we found out we were pregnant," Pinkett Smith told People. "That's right. When Pinkett Smith walked down the aisle in a velvet champagne-colored gown on December 31, 1997, she was 3 months pregnant with her first child." The two married in a private ceremony at a hotel in Pinkett Smith's native city of Baltimore. There were no invitations sent, according to People, because the couple wanted to avoid any potential leaks to the media, which explains why there are very few photos of their big day floating around the interwebs. But Pinkett Smith posted the above Polaroid snap on Twitter of the pair sharing a New Year's Eve kiss shortly after saying their I do's. And it's a black and white photo, and Jada is in her velvet dress, and Will is bending over and kissing her, and he's in a white t-shirt and a white dress shirt. On Red Table Talk, Pinkett Smith finally opened up about her wedding day, but it wasn't the fairy tale we all might have imagined. "I was so upset that I had to have a wedding," she remembered. "I was pissed. I went crying down the freaking aisle getting married." July 1998, Pinkett Smith gave birth to their son, Jaden Smith. First came love, then came marriage, and, well, you know the rest. Pinkett Smith welcomed her first son, Jaden Christopher Sire Smith, on July 8, 1998, in a speedy delivery. "The doctor said it would take an hour and a half to deliver him," she told Fit Pregnancy. "I said, oh, it's not going to take that long. I'm too anxious to meet this baby. It took me 20 minutes to push him out. My mother's a nurse, and she was in there with me, and she was amazed." Jaden quickly followed in his parents' superstar footsteps, catching the acting bug and inheriting the music gene from his rock star mother and rapper-actor father. Unlike Pinkett Smith, their son has starred in two movies with his dad, After Earth in 2013 and The Pursuit of Happiness in 2006. He also released his debut studio album in 2017, Sire, and that's spelled S-Y-R-E, which is taken from his middle name. October 2000, their second child, Willow Smith, was born. Nearly 2 years later, the Smiths welcomed their daughter, Willow Camille Rain Smith, on October 31st, 2000. Smith confirmed his daughter's conception happened on a drunken trip in Mexico on VH1's Dear Mama special. "I'm not going to be silly," Smith said during his opening monologue. "I'm here to honor you. Just watching the piece with the kids, it takes me back to when we made them. Can't help but think about that. It's just amazing. It's like you take Jada Pinkett Smith and an obscure town in Mexico and some tequila, and you end up with great kids." Like her big brother, Willow also became a fixture on the entertainment scene, appearing in the 2007 movie I Am Legend alongside her father. Her first song, Whip My Hair, was released in 2010 and thrust her into the spotlight. Later, she began working as a model and co-hosted Red Table Talk with her mother and grandmother, Adrienne Banfield Norris. Willow still sings, too. She released her fifth solo album, Coping Mechanism, in 2022. April 2013, Pinkett Smith denied being in an open relationship. After an interview with HuffPost Live on April 3, 2013, Pinkett Smith's comments about her marriage raised a few eyebrows. "I've always told Will you can do whatever you want as long as you can look at yourself in the mirror and be okay," she said, "because at the end of the day, Will is his own man. I'm here as his partner, but he is his own man. He has to decide who he wants to be, and that's not for me to do for him, or vice versa." This caused many people to believe she was admitting to being in an open relationship with Smith. Pinkett Smith would later clarify her statement on her personal Facebook account, opening up her intimate post with the question, "Open marriage?" "The statement I made in regard to Will can do whatever he wants has illuminated the need to discuss the relationship between trust and love and how they coexist," she wrote. August 2015, the Smiths confirmed their marriage was rock solid again. Because of the way the rumor mill works, people continued to predict that the couple was headed for Splitsville. In 2015, Smith was forced to state the obvious again on Facebook. In the interest of redundant, repetitious, over and over again-ness, Jada and I are not getting a divorce. 2016, Pinkett Smith had an entanglement with August Alsina while she and Smith were separated. On a revelatory 2020 episode of Red Table Talk, Pinkett Smith shared that she was separated from Smith in 2016 and that she and R&B singer August Alsina were involved in a relationship during that period. At the time, she said she and Smith were over. In the episode, Pinkett and Smith calmly sat down across from Smith and explained to viewers that Alsina had come into their lives when he was sick and that it felt good to be able to help him. "I just wanted to feel good. It had been so long since I felt good," she told viewers about her relationship with Alsina, whom she had been helping as he struggled with addiction. "And it was really a joy to just help heal someone. I think that has a lot to do with my codependency. I definitely realized you can't find happiness outside yourself," Pinkett Smith added. Smith also revealed that during that dark chapter of their marriage, he wasn't sure if they'd ever speak again. However, they persevered after a lot of what Will called therapizing, and Jada facing both the ugly truths about herself and the beautiful ones. "We came together young, and we were both broken in our own ways, and to be able to make mistakes without the fear of losing your family is so critical," Will said. Now they have unconditional love for each other, and they added. May 2018, Pinkett Smith invited Smith's ex-wife to Red Table Talk. On the May 2018 premiere episode, Motherhood, of Red Table Talk, Pinkett Smith extended an invitation to an unexpected guest, Smith's ex-wife, Zampino. The two women were completely respectful toward each other during their frank discussion, speaking candidly about their rocky past and how Zampino's son, with Smith, Trey, led to them becoming friends and a blended family. July 2018, Smith referred to Pinkett Smith as his life partner, not wife. After being together for more than two decades, the Smiths revealed that they're well beyond relationship labels and traditional unions, as proven by a conversation Smith had on Tidal's Rap Radar podcast in 2018. "We don't even say we're married anymore," Smith explained. "We refer to ourselves as life partners, where you get into that space where you realize you are literally with somebody for the rest of your life. There's no deal breakers. There's nothing she could do, ever, nothing that would break our relationship. She has my support till death, and it feels so good to get to that space." Pinkett Smith echoed her husband's sentiments during a 2018 interview on Sway in the Morning. "Here's the thing about Will and I. It's like we are family that's never going down," she said. "It doesn't matter all the relationships and what people think, ideas of a husband and a partner and all that, man, whatever. At the end of the day, there's a man that can rely on me for the rest of his life, period." 2019, the couple took their love to higher heights, literally by skydiving for Smith's 50th birthday. As a promise to her husband to do whatever he wanted for his 50th birthday celebration, Pinkett Smith threw caution and her fear of heights to the wind and went skydiving in Dubai with her partner of over 22 years. Smith documented the experience on his Facebook watch series, Will Smith's Bucket List. "Jada, you know she's been the glue of our family and a mother and a wife," Smith said during the desert excursion. "Our life can be wildly constricting for her. I think she was going to experience the greatest rush of freedom and exhilaration that she's ever had in her life." April 2019, the Smiths supported each other at the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival. The Smiths headed to Southern California to celebrate Jaden's debut at the annual music festival. During Jaden's electric performance in the first weekend, Willow and family friend Jordan Woods made a surprise appearance. But the crowd really went wild when his father joined him on stage to perform Icon during the weekend two set. Smith documented the entire experience in the Desert Valley in the YouTube video below. May 2019, Pinkett Smith revealed how she handled Smith's female fans in an episode of Red Table Talk. On May 6th, chef and lifestyle guru Ayesha Curry pulled up a chair at the Red Table to chat about everything, from anxiety to groupies. After Curry shared how she deals with women following her husband, Steph Curry, around when he's traveling on the road, she turned the question back over to Pinkett Smith. who joked about her daughter, Willow, having her back. I remember when Willow was like 5 or 6 and one of Will's co-stars was in his trailer, Pinkett Smith said, and she came in there and she jumped in her father's lap and she looked at the co-star and she said, "My mother's going to be here very soon." I remember Will telling me that story and I cracked up. Pinkett Smith added, "There was only like 1 or 2 times where I might have gotten a little hostile when I felt like people stepped over a boundary and they were disrespectful. I think also you need to have an internal space of confidence. I know who I am, and more important, he knows who I am." 2020, the coronavirus pandemic created a new dynamic in the couple's marriage. During a Red Table Talk episode titled "How Your Relationship Can Survive Quarantine," Pinkett Smith said, "I have to be honest. I think one of the things that I've realized is that I don't know Will at all." So how did the couple work through that realization? "The thing Will and I are learning to do is to be friends," Pinkett Smith elaborated. "You get into all these ideas of what intimate relationships are supposed to look like and what marriages are supposed to be," she added. "Will and I are in the process of him taking the time to learn to love himself, me taking the time to learn to love myself right, and us building a friendship along the way." September 2021, Will says marriage can't be a prison. In a revealing interview with GQ, Smith told the interviewer that he also had other relationships while Pinkett Smith was dating Alcina. He elaborated on a topic Pinkett Smith has been open about on Red Table Talk. She doesn't necessarily agree with the traditional expectations put on marriage. Jada never believed in conventional marriage. Jada had family members that had had an unconventional relationship, he told the publication. So she grew up in a way that was very different than how I grew up. There were significant, endless discussions about what is relational perfection, what is the perfect way to interact as a couple, and for the large part of our relationship, monogamy was what we chose, not thinking of monogamy as the only relational perfection. He also spoke about freedom in marriage. We've given each other trust and freedom with the belief that everybody has to find their own way. And marriage for us can't be a prison. And I don't suggest our road for anybody. I don't suggest this road for anybody. But the experiences that the freedoms that were given one another and the unconditional support to me is the highest definition of love. November 2021, Will released his memoir, Will. The tell-all revealed plenty of details about Smith's career and childhood, but the actor who wrote about his relationship with Pinkett Smith, "My divorce from Cherie wasn't yet final, so Jada and I decided it would be prudent if we kept our relationship under wraps. We were both pretty famous, and we felt it just wouldn't have been a great look," he writes in the book. "The blessed yet unintended consequence was that we spent every single moment together, just us. The first 3 or 4 months were as wild a romantic whirlwind as our bodies could have possibly handled." He continues, "We fit together so naturally, and our energies combined exponentially in a way that felt like old friends more than new lovers. We had an unspoken language, and everything we focused on flourished." After the memoir was released, Smith Starr sat down with Oprah for an interview and shared some sentiments about his relationship. "People are trying to put something on it, Will and Jada, what they're doing with other people. Will and Jada ain't really doing too much of nothing. Will and Jada are on a spiritual journey to cleanse the poisonous, unloving parts of our hearts, and we're doing it together in this lifetime, no matter what. Me and Jada, to this day, if we start talking, it's 4 hours. It's 4 hours if we exchange a sentence. It's the center of why we've been able to sustain our relationship and why we're still together, not choking the life out of each other. The ability to work through issues. I've never met another person that I connect with in conversation more blissfully and productively than Jada." March 2022, at the Oscars, Smith had a confrontation with Chris Rock. Otherwise known as the slap heard around the world, Smith approached the stage where Rock was hosting the Academy Awards and hit Rock in the face. Rock had just made an off-script comment about Pinkett Smith's appearance. She had previously revealed a journey with alopecia. And Smith, after slapping Rock, told him to keep his wife's name out of his mouth. The shocking moment caused a huge stir. Smith had, earlier that night, won the Best Actor Award for his performance in King Richard and eventually released an apology statement. "Violence in all of its forms is poisonous and destructive. My behavior at last night's Academy Awards was unacceptable and inexcusable," he wrote. "Jokes at my expense are a part of the job, but a joke about Jada's medical condition was too much for me to bear, and I reacted emotionally." October 2023, Pinkett Smith revealed that she and Smith have been separated since 2016. Ahead of the release of our upcoming memoir, Worthy, Pinkett Smith went on the Today Show to share that the pair are still separated and have been for years. They are still legally married, on paper, but they are essentially divorced in practice. Pinkett Smith had not previously shared the news because they were not ready. They were still trying to figure out between the two of them how to be in partnership, she explained in the interview. How do we present that to people? We hadn't figured that out. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Continuing on in culture and news, Beyoncé makes rare red carpet appearance for Taylor Swift's film premiere. Both women, who each made history with their world tours this year, have a long history of supporting each other. We don't often get to see Beyoncé on a red carpet anymore, with the superstar typically making a stealthy entrance into major award ceremonies by skipping the publicized ritual, but she seems to have made an exception for Taylor Swift. For the world premiere of Swift's concert film Taylor Swift The Eras Tour on Wednesday night, they supported the pop star with a surprise red carpet appearance at the Grove's AMC Theater in Los Angeles. She continued to channel her Renaissance tour wardrobe with a slick jumpsuit from Laquan Smith's Spring-Summer 2023 ready-to-wear collection, which consisted of a metallic silver bustier that sculpted the torso, as well as clingy black fabric making up the pant legs and long sleeves. She finished off the look with platform-heeled boots and a pair of sunglasses with futuristic silver embellishments. Meanwhile, Swift looked like a fairy tale in a pretty sky-blue gown from Oscar de la Renta's Resort 2023 collection. The piece featured multiple floral embellishments and cutouts, as well as a jacquard print resembling the texture of the interior of a flower petal. To accessorize, she wore Cartier jewelry and matching sky-blue heels. Swift later gave a shout-out to Beyoncé on Instagram, captioning a video of the two munching on popcorn together inside the theater. The maroon singer wrote, "I'm so glad. I'll never know what my life would have been like without." And there's the at symbol, Beyoncé's influence. "The way she's taught me and every artist out here to break rules and defy industry norms, her generosity of spirit, her resilience and versatility. She's been a guiding light throughout my career, and the fact that she showed up tonight was like an actual fairy tale." Both women broke records with their world tours this year. Beyoncé's Renaissance World Tour repeatedly made $579 million, making it the highest-grossing tour by a female artist and the seventh highest-grossing tour ever. As for the Eras Tour, Swift is projected to gross $1 billion in ticket sales, which would make it the first tour to ever do so. The superstars have a long history of supporting each other. Since Beyoncé invited Swift back on stage to give her acceptance speech at the 2009 VMAs, following Kanye West's infamous interruption, the two have been seen partying together and have celebrated each other's various achievements on social media. This article was from Harper's Bazaar, Us. Next in wellness, ice cream that's actually good for you. The founder of Protalicious, Sheila Partrat, spent years perfecting the formula for a whey protein powder-packed dessert that is healthy as it is delicious. Where the idea came from? "I studied food science at college and have been passionate about the pathways between food and health for a very long time. I was always looking for that holy grail, that one thing you can slip into your diet that will just make life easier and better. That happened when I was living in Hong Kong and I started taking a very clean whey protein concentrate, cold filter processed to maintain the essential amino acids. The difference was life-shifting. My immunity was better. I had more energy and better skin, hair, and nails. Everything shifted positively. I realized that so many people could benefit from this. It could make people's lives better." The initial goal: "I wanted to find a way to move two worlds. Wellness products often don't taste great, and gourmet products aren't sometimes healthy. I knew my product should bridge this gap, because these things have been divorced for far too long. First steps. First of all, I had to find a source for this high-quality protein. I wanted something that tasted absolutely delicious and had all the naturally occurring benefits. I gathered a small team and set up a test kitchen. It took some time, but we found a supplier in New Zealand with really excellent protein containing amazing amino acids. They took us on. even though our order quantity was small, because they could see we were shining a light on the benefits of their protein like nobody else did. The hardest moment. Once Protolicious was off the ground, I became obsessed with the idea of incorporating our protein into an ice cream. Something gourmet, with no compromises, but also high enough in protein to be able to stabilize sugar cravings. We made a prototype that worked super well and thought, okay, we've got something here. And then we tried to make it, and the recipe just wouldn't work. There was a ton of nail-biting while we worked with food scientists trying to make a gorgeous ice cream that still delivered the right amount of protein. I was shoving in my money and with no idea how it was going to come out the other side, but we did, and Parade Ice Cream was born. That's P-A-R-A-D. The moment you thought this just might work, I realized that the ice cream really had legs when we did a blind tasting in New York in 2022. The feedback was absolutely overwhelming. We had dietitians and food and beverage executives giving their honest opinions, and they just loved it. The results. We've made Parade Ice, that's P-A-R-A-D and then an exclamation mark ice, available online for distribution nationwide, and we're increasing the number of stores we'll sell it to. My kids are all in their 20s and have grown up with the company. They are all involved now, too, helping with everything from marketing to writing. When I close my eyes for the last time, I just want to make sure this will have made an impact in people's lives. Protolicious Whey Protein and Parade Ice Ice Cream each come in 3 different flavors. The Parade Ice comes in True Velvety Strawberry, True Madagascar Vanilla, and True Deep Chocolate. And the Protolicious comes in Gourmet Whey Protein True Strawberry, Gourmet Whey Protein True Chocolate, and Gourmet Whey Protein True Original, if you want to give these a try. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website. And that's ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org if you want to go on and find the podcast. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.